welcome to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. We're on the economy today, a good way to wind things up for myself. Oh, I'll explain more. Those listeners who missed my Wednesday program, I used the last segment to explain what that cryptic statement meant. So I'll keep you tuned in until we get to the end of the program. But anybody listening absolutely never tunes out, right? Anyway, we are on the economy today, and I'm delighted to have Jack Rasmus back. Jack is a professor of political economy at St. Mary's College and Santa Clara University in California. He's also a freelance journalist, frequent speaker. He's a playwright. He's an author. And he's got his newest book due out very shortly. It's called Epic Recession and Financial Crisis, Prelude to Global Depression. Now, if that isn't a headliner, I don't know what is. Jack, I welcome you. And do you have what's the airline term? ETA. Do you have an ETA on your book? Do you know when it's coming out?
Yes, it'll be available in general in bookstores May 1st, but people can pre-order on Amazon or going to Palgrave Macmillan.
I thought it was coming out in March.
No, that's the hardback comes out in March. But
the hardback is what I'm talking about. The book will be published in March.
Yes, the hardback is available in March, but the paperback is available in May 1st.
Ah, do you have a March date when it will?
No, just
not as yet.
Sometime. You know how publishers are.
Oh yeah, they do have their own way of doing things.
Yeah, I have no control over it, right?
Oh dear. Well, you know, they got a printed on thing, and that can take some time.
Right, but they can go to Amazon and pre-order, and as soon as it's available, you'll get it.
Let me just tell listeners, Jack, that I've read your articles that you sent me. They are absolutely on the money. They are enlightening. I call them must reading, which is why I love having you on this program all the time. And for you to put this in a book, it's not your first. You've got a few others as well. And I'll let you give your website so you can direct listeners on how they can find out about all your books. Of course, this is the latest one, so the one we want to headline. But there's no question in my mind that what you will have in it is must reading, especially given what we're going through right now. But, say more about it, and then we'll continue right after the break, Jack.
Yeah, well, I've been predicting, because I believe what the method I'm using here and the key forces that I'm looking at are really the important ones. I've been predicting the course of this whole epic recession for about 2 years now, and all my predictions are in my articles. I predicted a year before the collapse of unemployment. I predicted the banking crashes, and I've predicted the fact that this is not going to be a V-shaped recovery. It's going to be a stagnation. We're moving sideways, and that we're going to expect a W-shaped relapse. And just this month, it looks like that might be in the process. I also predicted that we're going to see some sovereign country defaults. And, of course, big news now is Greece, and right behind it are a couple more countries.
Oh, yeah.
So,
you
know, it's what you're looking at that's important. What I'm looking at is two concepts I call financial and consumption fragility, meaning that the debt run-up was so large that both businesses and consumers are so indebted that they can't work off the debt fast enough, and it's keeping the economy from recovering. And we don't have the right policies in Washington in order to generate a sustained recovery.
We got a break, Jack. Hold that thought.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Jack Rasmus. Oh, we do have countries that may go into default, Jack. I wonder if the shoes will begin dropping. At least five European countries that are in trouble. Greece is getting the most headlines, but those so-called PIGS country, P-I-G-S, but it's really five countries, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, and Greece. And we've got a couple of biggies that are really super in debt that I just wonder. I mean, if the PIGS fall, I wonder how far behind the others may get into big trouble. You know more about this than I do, but I know the UK and Japan are hugely in debt, much more than we are. But if a few of those go, and my God, if one of the big ones goes, can we be far behind?
Yes, well, it's all connected financially, of course, you know, and the first victims of this situation in these in the European periphery, which is in bad shape, will be probably banks in Austria and Italy, and then, of course, they're closely integrated with banks in Germany and France and elsewhere. So, you know, this is not an isolated event. And I, what's really interesting is you read the business press this morning, and it's quite clear that you've got U.S. banks speculating, like Goldman Sachs and others, heavily, and hedge funds exacerbating the crisis over there. In other words, betting that there's going to be a collapse, and in betting with credit default swaps that there will be, in effect, ensures that there will be. Just the same thing that happened on the eve of the banking panic here in the U.S. in September, October 2008. The hedge funds and other speculators started driving down the prices of these institutions. Now it's the currency of Europe, which will probably fall about a third. And they're out to make hundreds of billions of dollars on these bets. So what we got is speculators driving and exacerbating the situation, just as they did here 18 months ago. Same thing.
Oh, absolutely. You took the thought right out of my mind. And the fall of Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. There isn't a doubt in my mind that, I mean, these companies were no worse off than any of the others that are making billions of dollars now. Those companies didn't fall, they were pushed.
Exactly, they were pushed over by the others. I mean, you know, the big banks eat each other when they got an opportunity to make some money. And that's exactly what's happening. And we've got this parallel banking system called shadow banks. You know, the hedge funds, the private equity firms, the private banks, money mutual funds, and so forth. And in my book, I try to point out that a big problem we've got globally is what I call the global money parade. There's about 10 to 20 trillion, not billion, trillion dollars in the hands of very wealthy investors and institutions. And this money just sloshes around the global economy whenever there is an opportunity to make some speculative profits. Speculative profits are driven by price increases, exceptional price rises or price declines, and they jump in there and make a quick capital gains of you know, billions and hundreds of billions of dollars, and then they go on to the next bubble. They create bubbles or they follow bubbles and make bubbles worse. And, you know, they found, oh, there's a bubble possibility over here in Europe and the sovereign states, and we're going to now push this and make as much as we can. And all that money floating and sloshing around, you know, is money that could be and should be going to real investment that creates real jobs for real people. But the banks and others are just going after the quick buck. You know, the banks in this country, U.S. banks, recovered somewhat in the last year, especially because of going after these speculative opportunities. We got a big problem here. We put several trillion dollars into the banks to bail them out in the U.S., and now we got a big budget deficit as a result. And are the banks lending to real business, small, medium businesses, you know, where the jobs create? No. Bank lending in the U.S. has collapsed 12 months in a row. It's fallen. So what are they doing with all this zero interest rate free money they get from the Federal Reserve? Well, they're taking it and they're investing in these speculative opportunities all over the world. Hedge funds get their money from the big banks, from Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase. In fact, these big banks have their own hedge funds, and they loan to other hedge funds, and then the hedge funds pay the banks 10-12%. Banks get their money from nothing from the Fed. They get 10-12% from the hedge funds, and the hedge funds go and invest in currencies around the world, in stock markets around the world, Chinese property, commodities, and so forth. And that's how the banks have made their money in the past year. And we're financing it. The taxpayers financing it, and they're not doing anything to generate the recovery. And that's the big problem with Obama's strategy. You know, at the top of his strategy was, okay, let's bail out the banks first, not Main Street, not workers, not small businesses, and they will start lending, and the market will recover, right? Well, it just hasn't happened because we bailed them out, and they're going offshore, and they're speculating all this these markets, which was the problem in the first place, the success speculation. My book talks about this role of the speculative shift globally going on at the expense of real investment and real jobs. And that's at the heart of this all, which leads to the financial instability and the financial busts, which then provoke the real economic collapse. And I trace this, been going on building for at least 25 years here. And it's not unique. It happened in the 1920s, and it happened in the first decade of the 1900s, and it happened in every depression we've had.
And, Jack, it's really shocking.
That's where we are, yes.
That we have a government, doesn't matter whether it's a Republican or a Democrat government. My feeling is that the Democrats can get away with more horrendous policies than the Republicans would ever try. Especially a guy coming in on a wave of popularity, Obama, and the policy literally is, I mean, there are smart people there. They know exactly what they're doing, and they're staffed by people that from former Wall Street firms, or a Geithner who was president of the New York Fed. They literally wrecked the economy to bail out the banks, and the big ones, of course. And another way the banks have made money, as you know, Jack, is that they suspended the mark-to-market rule. So they've got God knows how many trillions of dollars of toxic assets on their books that nobody wants. And they're just sitting there. They're not declaring losses. They're just sitting there. You know, I mean, is this stuff ever going to come back and have any value? I just can't imagine. I mean, when are you going to do something with this stuff?
No, most of it, some of it will come back, but most of it will not. Before the crisis, we had a $2 trillion securitization market. In other words, they were taking auto loans and credit card loans and student loans and mortgage loans and stuff like that, and they were repackaging them, marking them up, making a paper profit, marking them up again and again. And that market was worth $2 trillion. It's collapsed. The bank bailout proposals of last year, particularly the TALF, the Term Asset Lending Facility of the Federal Reserve, was supposed to get that $2 trillion market going. Well, they got like $50, $60 billion in deals in the past year, so it's dead. They can't get it going. The question is, if you can't get it going, what does that mean for the economic recovery? And that's questionable. And the other big question is, if you can't get jobs going, what does that mean for the economy? And if you keep having housing foreclosures and the collapse of the housing industry, and we just had some recent news here that new housing starts are falling again, then where's the sustained recovery coming from? Obama's fundamental strategy was wrong, and I wrote about it a year ago, focusing on the banks, the market, and the banks who caused the problem to lead us out of the problem. Well, it's not happening, and, it didn't happen in the past. Historically, I have three chapters in my book which looked at, in the U.S., three other periods where exactly the same thing happened, as well as a theoretical part, as well as an alternative program to Obama's program.
Well, I look forward to reading it, Jack. I really do. Again, you don't only nail the issues cold, but your writing is very easy to anybody to follow. You don't have to be an economist to understand what you're talking about. You write for ordinary people. They can read this stuff, and they can understand exactly what's going on, what's the cause of it, and then you propose very sensible solutions. I guess that's in the book also.
Yes, well, you know, why write for economists? You know, there've been 10,000 of them around the world, and you can probably count on two hands how many were right predicting what was happening.
Well, look who they work for. That's the reason.
Well, you know, yes, they don't want to be too extreme. Well, we got an extreme situation, and it takes an analysis, truthful analysis of what the situation is. But you know, most of the time, they're more concerned about their careers than telling the truth. So,
oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm
not interested in, you know, other than the saying it as it is, and of course, you know, telling people what's happening in terms that they can understand, of course.
Jack, it's very rare that you have an economist working for one of the big firms who actually tells it right. One of them, we've mentioned him on the program before. I mention him quite often. David Rosenberg was with Merrill Lynch. He's now with a small Canadian firm, and he puts out a daily report. It's terrific reading. He really crams a lot in it, and he does it every single day. Once in a while, he takes a day off or a holiday or whatever. But in one of his reports last week, he talked about, it's this huge problem, declining credit. That, I mean, it's just cascading down. It just keeps going. And he mentioned that year-to-date so far, which was, getting a little bit close to the end of February, the rate of decline was at an historic level. I forget the percentage, but at an historic level. And his conclusion was that the credit decline isn't easing. It's accelerating.
Yes, well, that's what I call consumption fragility. That's part of the picture of consumption fragility.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
I can't imagine a more important topic to be discussing than the economy, along, of course, with war and peace. And that's another issue we talk about in other programs. We'll sure revisit that. That's a gruesome situation, Jack. Nobody can look into the future and know with certainty what's coming. But it strikes me, I don't think you have to be an economist. I think anybody with a level head ought to come to this conclusion. When you have bad policies, they yield bad results, no matter what the short-term ones are. So, you know, we have a cancer, and we took a strong pain reliever, and the pain has abated a bit, but the cancer is still there, and the longer we continue with bad policies, the worse the end result will be. I mean, that to me seems like the logical conclusion.
Yes, but you got to remember, it's not the policies that fundamentally caused this situation. The situation I'm describing about the shift towards more and more speculative investing.
Well, Jack, let me stop you there. I'm not talking about the cause. I'm talking about the solutions to address the cause.
Yes, of course. Yeah, it certainly the policies can exacerbate the situation and prevent a readjustment and a recovery, and that's exactly what's going on here. And that's because of the power of the financial interests and their lobbyists and so forth, they've been able to pretty much thwart and block any kind of adjustments here, financial reform and re-regulation and so forth. And it doesn't look like there is going to be any serious financial regulation of these banks until the crisis gets worse, which is quite possible. I suspect that if we have another banking crisis like we did, the banking panic we did in 2008, that we're going to be on a totally different qualitative level of the crisis here. And that might provoke some more serious concern, you might say, but even then might not. That's the big problem. Politics is blocking any real recovery going on.
Jack, I'll let you finish up with a few more comments in this segment. In the second half of the program, there are some major issues I'd love for you to get into. The fact that we're planning a different budget situation. Well, I mean, we're going to have deficits, horrendous deficits as far as the eye can see. But Obama is talking about making domestic discretionary budget cuts, pulling back rather than full throttle, full speed ahead. The Fed is also juggling. We had that discount rate hike. I think by itself it doesn't mean a lot, but it may be the first step in an effort to juggle an effort to support the dollar, or at least create the impression of wanting to support the dollar. And at the same time, you've got the terrible problem if you cut back on protecting the banks. If you keep spending money recklessly or printing money recklessly, the problem we will face anyway will be that much greater. So on the one hand, you've got maybe a growing inflation at some point in the future. That certainly isn't the issue now. But you print money like toilet paper, sooner or later it's not going to be worth anything. So you've got that problem that you need to pull back from, and you've got the other issue of protecting the dollar for all the reasons that's important, and it seems like a tug-of-war, and I don't know how this is going to come out, but I'd like your views on that. Maybe you can start, and then we'll continue in the second half.
Sure. Okay, let's talk about where the economy is. You know, we've got a GDP, gross domestic product, small boost here, second half of last year. But if you look at it in its particulars, it's pretty clear that it's not really sustainable. It's primarily driven a little bit by U.S. exports increasing, by some technicalities of inventory adjustments. Okay, and of course, to some extent, the Obama stimulus. The exports-driven part is soon going to fade. It's already beginning to fade because the dollar is rising in value. China is pulling back, and the euro is about to collapse by 30%, all of which will make U.S. exports more expensive. So the export-driven bubble here, a little surge last year, is going to dissipate this year. Inventory adjustment has run its course. There's no further reductions that they can offset. And the stimulus, of course, is designed to really peter out here about mid-year this year. And we're beginning to see some other indicators that show the economy is slowing down. Once again, the durable goods orders are down. Consumer confidence is down. Initial jobless claims are shooting back up again. Business spending is flat, and new home sales are declining. these are all ominous indicators, and of course, the stock market sees this, and the stock market is beginning to pull back as well. And then we've got the uncertainty, financial uncertainty, what's going on in Europe, in the Middle East, financially in the banking systems, etc. So, as I predicted, this recovery, quote, is going to be very moderate, very short-lived, and we're going to slip back. And this is exactly what happened after the 1907 financial collapse. And for 6 years, it was stagnation until World War I. As far as budgets are concerned, we're looking at $1 trillion budgets at minimum, according to the Congressional Budget Office here, for the next 5 years. That's massive. How they're going to deal with that without raising taxes on the wealthy is impossible. Either that or they're going to have to tax Social Security again, which is a possibility.
I have no idea what they're going to do. There's such sensible things they should do, but they won't. They cut the defense budget in half.
No, that's not going to happen.
It won't happen. Yeah.
Right, right.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Jack Rasmus. Jack, let me let you pick up where we left off, if you recalled precisely where you were when the break
sure.
came.
I think you had raised a couple questions or points that are really worth elaborating on. You need to understand that there is no one banking system. In the U.S., there's really three banking systems. One is, of course, getting all the attention, the big banks, you know, the Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan's, Chase, Citigroup's, Bank of America, so forth. those are the banks that they bailed out. There's about 8,000 other small regional banks in this country, and they're not being bailed out. They're being consolidated. The FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, is a government agency that is responsible for the consolidation of these banks. And there's about 700 of them in its recent report that are in trouble. Probably going to be more than 700. I predicted about 500 of these will go under because they are really exposed to a credit market that is really in very bad shape, and that's the market for a commercial property, which is catching up in terms of its problems to the residential mortgage market, the commercial mortgage market. That's prices are falling there, defaults are beginning to rise at these companies, and somehow the Fed's going to have to directly bail them out in some way. But then you got this picture of the Federal Reserve, quasi-government agency, trying to bail out non-financial institutions. But it looks like they can't get that market going again. It's $3.5 trillion market here in the U.S., the commercial property market. So the small banks are the small and regional banks, 8,000 are the second segment. The third segment are what we call shadow banks. These are the hedge funds, private equity, private banks, et cetera. a lot of them went under, but those that didn't have consolidated, and they're more powerful than ever. And they are major players in this European sovereign crisis, as we're beginning to see. So the hedge funds and so forth are the banking segment that is focusing primarily on a lot of speculation. But the big banks are tied into the shadow banks because they provide a lot of the loans. So if the shadow banks take big risks and go under, then what happens is they drag the other banks, which is what's happened here over the last 2 years. And that's still going on. You know, we still don't have a separation between these two. And even more important, it's the big banks tied into the speculation. The big banks aren't loaning. And what we need in this country is a utility banking system. In other words, we should have a totally non-profit banking structure for loans to mortgages, to auto loans, to student loans, to these loans that Main Street and the rest of the country really need. Take it out of the speculative profit sphere and, have a true government central banking system that loans to people and to small businesses.
Jack, the idea that we will have some segment of the banking industry that really are banks, not casinos.
Yes.
Which raises another point in my mind, and it's an idea that I discussed with Ellen Brown in this program, and that's the idea of state publicly owned banks. And there's only one state in the country that's been awfully healthy, and that's North Dakota. Because since 1919, it's the only state in the country with a publicly owned bank.
Mm-hmm.
And they had their biggest ever surplus in 2009. This horrendous 2009, they had the biggest surplus in the state's history. What do you think of the idea of if every state, or if some of the key ones, California, New York, my own state of Illinois, that is in absolutely dismal shape. I mean, you're in California, and Illinois scaled down. You've got, every time you close your deficit, you have new problems and it opens back up again. And the last number I saw for Illinois was $13 billion. They're talking about doing some horrendous things, which can only make things worse. Same thing in California. You know, lay people off, cut the budget, raise taxes, and play an English check. How the hell do you get out of an economic mess by putting a greater burden on the people who live in your state? You can't.
Yes, well, it's a black hole that they've been pouring money into, and the black hole doesn't close up. You know, exactly like you say, as long as the crisis continues, as long as there's no real economic recovery, again, because Obama has the wrong program, the conditions in the state will continue to get worse. The stimulus, maybe close to half of the stimulus, his initial stimulus, was really offset by growing deficits in the states. So it's not a $787 billion stimulus. It's maybe $400 billion. And over half of that is tax cuts, which have no effect, particularly business tax cuts in this kind of a situation of the economy. So there really isn't that much stimulus when you come to look at it. That's why it hasn't had much of effect in in generating a sustained recovery. You know, all they've been able to do is put a floor under the collapse, hoping that the banks would pull us out. That's the fundamental strategic error they've made. And that means the government has to step in much more vigorously and directly to do something first about the housing problem, like they did during the 1930s. What did FDR do? Did he ask the lenders, the mortgage lenders, please modify your loans and help these folks out? No. He stepped in and he took over these lenders, and those that were in trouble, he threw them out of business. He forced them to merge and everything. And the government directly went to homeowners and said, okay, we're going to lower your monthly payments. Now contrast that, and they did. They lowered the monthly payments, right? The principal payments, not just for those who were in trouble, but for everybody who had these loans and these lender and mortgage and SNLs that were in trouble. We just don't see that kind of direct, let's take charge attitude and clean this thing up by the government right now. And the reason is that the money in politics, right? The number one campaign contributor industry to Obama was, of course, guess what? Bank and finance companies, right? He got his initial push from buddies in the hedge fund industry that he roomed with at Harvard, you know, and great friends of his. So, you know, when you're that in debt to political interests, it's pretty hard to take a bold step forward and do what needs to be done. But until they go in and take charge and actually reset these mortgages and interest rates, whether the lenders like it or not voluntarily anymore, you're not going to see an end to this housing crisis. Okay, that's the first thing. And until they go in and start investing publicly, you know, why shouldn't the government engage in launching these new technologies, these new alternative energy companies and so forth, establish public investment trusts? You know, if the economy recovers, then you can talk about what you want to do with them. But the government should be hiring, not the sweeping streets and stuff like that, but all these new technologies. Let's really get them going. And there's all kinds of opportunities. We need to rebuild our infrastructure in this country. It's falling apart. There's no lack of possible ways of really getting real jobs going again. But the government has to be much more direct and aggressive in doing it. And the private sector will not do it on its own.
I mean, you know this stuff, and they know this stuff again. There are not a bunch of dummies running things in Washington. These are smart people. They know what the bad policies are. They know what the good policies are. And it's a very easy conclusion to decide. They deliberately chose the wrong policies in deference to the people who mean the most of them, the giant financial institutions, the whole fire industry, finance, insurance, and real estate. And these are the people who meant the most. And this continues. And again, the policies going forward, I haven't seen even a hint of change in terms of wanting to pull back from these people. The only changes I've seen seem to maybe will make things worse. The idea that you'll do less to help people. I mean, you really haven't done very much at all up to now, and you're going to do even less. My God, as bad as things are now, and to say that, you know, the recession is over, Bernanke gets up there. I love what Michael Hudson calls Bernanke. He calls him a useful idiot, a guy who I mean, if he really believes that the stuff that he spews, he's a guy that couldn't pass a basic economics course, because what he's doing is exactly the opposite of what he should be doing. So maybe a useful idiot is
I don't think Bernanke is a fool, you know, and I don't think he is ignorant about economics.
Oh, he's
in a very political position. I'm not defending him, but, you know, basically he is the spokesperson for the big banks within whatever administration. That's the role the Fed plays, okay? You don't become the chairman of the Fed without the quiet backroom approval of all the big banks. So when he gets in there, he's going to try to walk a tightrope between what the government wants and needs and what's good for the country and what the banks want.
Well, the tightrope, Jack, the rhetoric is good-sounding, but the policy is bad. The policy is pro-Wall Street. Whatever Wall Street wants, Wall Street gets.
Yes, well, you know, that's part of the problem that we have now, and that's why we can't move forward. The financial re-regulation legislation that's been moving through the Senate is so mild, so moderate. There's a big question whether it could work if it even got passed, but the banks are fighting it every step of the way and preventing it, you know.
Well,
that is not sufficient.
There'll be nothing with teeth. And another thing that just popped in my mind, the so-called jobs bill, $15 billion.
Oh, yeah, that's a joke, isn't it?
I mean, it's a $13 trillion economy. I mean, $15 billion. I mean, that's a bad drop in the bucket.
Well, that's a election year tokenism is what that is, you know. That's not going to generate anything. That's just so the politicians can come back home and say, "Oh, we passed the jobs bill," right? No, that's not going to, like you say, it's a drop in the bucket.
It's going to do absolutely nothing.
No.
Last year we needed to
spend about $1 trillion on job creation across various industries, and it's only spent with the proof of job creation. In other words, no one gets a penny unless you really prove you've created jobs. Not to save jobs, you know, that nonsense about save jobs from being laid off. And there's no way to verify that. People, companies and state and local government just take the money and say, "Oh, we saved jobs. You know, we would have laid it." Well, anybody can say that. But I mean real job creation in real sectors, balanced, and really serious, you know, which was just, what, one-third of what we gave the banks? Now, why can't we give the rest of the country and people who need work and small businesses one-third if we gave the banks? We gave the banks three times as much and they did nothing. Well, let's try giving one-third to the rest of the country and see if we can get something.
Jack, I'll throw in one comment. I know a little bit about job creation firsthand. Part of a small business for most of my working life. There's only one reason companies add jobs: when the business climate is better and orders are flowing in at a higher rate, and you don't have enough people to handle things, then you hire more. If business is rotten, if you fear that it won't get better and may get worse, you'd be a lunatic to hire people. We never did. In my 30-odd years in small business, we wouldn't hire a single person unless the climate could justify it. So you could give companies some kind of a government dole as an incentive to hire people. It's not going to happen.
Well, you just made the argument why tax cuts for businesses don't have any effect.
That's right.
And why even interest rates, when they're low, at 1-3%, don't have any effect, because just as you say, you can cut the cost of investment for businesses, and they're not going to invest unless they see someone able and willing to buy their goods. You know, that's when they'll invest and expand. And the problem is 70%, the consumption side of the economy, is flat and not recovering because people are so deep in debt, because they're so terribly fearful of their jobs, because their 401k plans have collapsed, because they can't get credit anymore, et cetera, et cetera. That's why consumption's not coming back. And as long as consumption doesn't come back, business spending won't come back, and that's the crux of the problem.
By the way, Rosenberg makes the case that there isn't a single example, as far as he can go back in U.S. history, which is, I guess, let's say the last century, that CapEx spending would drive a recovery. Apparently, I haven't noticed, but apparently there have been headlines in the news that capital expenditures will be the engine, be the recovery engine, even if consumers don't pick up. And he says, that's a bunch of malarkey. He says, if it happens, it'll be the first time in our history. It's not going to happen.
Right. Capital spending follows consumption spending, unless it's for exports. In other words, people offshore wanting to buy our goods, that will stimulate some capital spending. And we've had a little bump in exports. But as I said, now that the dollar is rising and China is shutting down and the euro is about to collapse, Forget exports. You can't export your way out of the crisis. It's that simple.
By the way, do you see at some point down the road the end of the euro?
No, I don't see the end of the euro, but I see a significant decline, depreciation of the euro. Yes. Of course, it's not impossible, but the alternative for the Europeans of allowing the euro to collapse and each one going its way again is just so startling that I think they will protect the euro. But the euro is with these sovereign crises, is going to be under tremendous pressure, and it will fall. Okay, which means if the euro falls and the dollar rises, which cuts off U.S. exports. So it's very, you know, what happens to the euro is very negative for the United States export sales.
And at the same time, Bernanke needs to do something to protect the dollar. One reason is we want people to buy our treasury bonds. I understand we had a couple of good auctions recently, even though the Chinese apparently are net sellers now, not buying. But is it the best of the worst alternatives in the fixed income market? There are people. Rosenberg thinks that that buying treasuries is a good deal in this environment, that the economy will get awfully weak and treasuries will appreciate.
I can comment on that when we come back.
Okay, break. We'll be right back.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. Jack, before I let you get on to that point, I meant to end the program at 10 minutes to the hour, as I mentioned to you in an email. I didn't do it. No problem. It's important that I announce I did this on Wednesday. Today is my last program on Republic Broadcasting. Rather sad day for me. I've enjoyed working with John Stadmiller. He's been very gracious to me, but he ended the program. It is ending, but not me. I continue on. I already have a Thursday program on the Progressive Radio Network. Very simple to Google and find it. All my programs are archived. And beginning tomorrow and Sunday, I will have weekend programs. It'll be 2 hours later than this program. This one goes on at 10 a.m. Central Time, U.S. Central Time. That's the same time for my Thursday program on PRN. And weekends beginning tomorrow, it'll be at noon Central Time. So I urge my listeners to follow me. You can still hear me not five times a week, but three times a week. Please do. Go to the Progressive Radio Network website. You'll see the schedule. You'll see the guests. Continue listening to this program. Jack, let me let you use the rest of the hour to address that point.
Yes, you were talking about the federal discount rate increasing, and what does this mean in terms of maybe the Fed and administration supporting the dollar rather than supporting economic recovery. I've been saying this for over a year, that ever since Geithner went to China and tried to assure the Chinese that we're not going to let the dollar fall, and thus, if it did, the value of all the reserves, dollar reserves they're holding, would collapse, which is what they need to assure them for them to continue buying U.S. bonds to keep the whole charade going here. That the administration has been drifting towards a decision to support the dollar over supporting domestic economic recovery. And that's why the Fed will start raising interest rates, but not until after the November election, I predict. They'll do other things to explain that they're moving in that direction, but they won't actually raise rates until after. We're going to see how sensitive the U.S. economy is going to be to any kind of interest rates. I think, given its very fragile condition, that even moderate, mild readjustments of federal funds rates and other rates upward is going to have a very negative effect on the economy. It's not going to take much to throw the economy back into a relapse here, which is already beginning to emerge. So they have a real contradiction. That is, do they protect the dollar in order to keep borrowing from abroad, or do they look at domestic economic recovery? And there's not much wiggle room for them with regard to that, and that's one of the big problems that they're facing, I think. And one of the main reasons, as well as continuing big loads of debt on balance sheets by companies, banks, and consumers, big reasons why we're not getting any really sustained recovery, which has to be consumer-driven.
Jack, we're out of time. Damned if they do, damned if they don't. And as far as I'm concerned, damn on all of them, because they made this mess. Certainly the banks made it, and we need some leaders in Washington that'll help get us out of it. We don't have them. Jack, my great thanks. I look forward to next time, later in March, on the Progressive Radio Network, and to your book as well. Many thanks, Jack. Stay tuned for Ernie. He'll be right on.